I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
A lot of reaction is coming in. It's where we stand here at 4 o'clock tonight. The shooting of a man who was known to feed people barbecue for free, including police officers in West Louisville, has rocked our community. Hello, everyone. I'm Doug Prophet. Here's what we know. Last night, just after midnight, barbecue business owner David McAtee was with a group of people outside his business at 26th and Broadway, Dino's, outside a business there, when police and Kentucky National Guardsmen approached. In the video we're about to show you, recorded by Chris Smith, you will see the police attempting to break up the large crowd. One shot is fired. The chief says that came from somewhere in the crowd. Then the governor says both LMPD and the National Guard opened fire.
On this edition of Parallax Views, what you just heard was a portion of a local news report from Kentucky regarding the death of David McAtee, a black small business owner beloved by his community, after the National Guard was called in to, along with the police, institute a curfew and quell protests in Louisville. Now we're going to play a little bit more from that report, including the audio from the video mentioned in the excerpt that you just heard. Trigger warning, it is disturbing stuff.
I'm gone.
Soon as I get my keys.
Okay, there you go. That's all you had to say. Shots fired. Shots fired. Shots fired. Look, they all got their guns out. Shots fired. Shots fired.
That's the video from Chris Smith there recorded. As you see, police were asking people to leave, and as Chris Smith was saying on his own video, they were going to leave. In fact, he was on his way out. Governor Beshear says there are multiple videos from body cameras of the shooting, and he was told Mayor Fisher to make the video available to the public so they can see whether there's justification or not.
Joining us to discuss this tragic case and elucidate the ways in which sending the National Guard to institute curfews and quell dissent can lead to fatal consequences for American citizens is Dave DeCamp of antiwar.com, author of the recent piece, The Danger of Sending in the Troops, The Killing of David McAtee. In addition to discussing this case, Dave also takes some time with us to discuss his piece on the US-backed Saudi bombing campaign against the Arab country of Yemen. As outlined in his article, as coronavirus rips through Yemen, Saudi bombs continue to fall. This second story highlights what some consider one of the worst humanitarian crises occurring today. It's all about the United States at war, both at home and abroad, on this edition of Parallax Views. And now, on to our conversation with Dave DeCamp of antiwar.com. Welcome to Parallax Views. Dave DeCamp, assistant news editor at antiwar.com and author of the piece at antiwar.com, June 15th, 2020, The Danger of Sending in the Troops, The Killing of David McGatty. We're going to talk about that, but first I want to ask, how are you doing during these crazy times we find ourselves in, Dave?
I'm doing good, JG. Thanks for having me on. I live in Brooklyn, so we, you know, the virus hit us pretty hard here, but my wife and I are, we've been doing good. We've both been going to work, my day job. I've been working the whole time, so I've been staying busy, which is good, because you could go crazy, you know, sitting at home. But how about you? How are things about you?
Pretty good, pretty good. I'm here in Pittsburgh, PA, so it's been crazy here on and off, and I'm actually in the part of Pittsburgh that's been having a lot of issues with COVID, so just trying to stay safe right now, though. So I wanted to ask you about antiwar.com and how you started working there, because I may have some listeners that are unfamiliar with antiwar.com, although I've been a fan since my teens, as I was telling you off the air.
Yeah, so antiwar.com, it's one of the oldest websites on the internet. It was started in 1995 by Eric Garris, who still runs the site, and the late Justin Raimondo, who was a regular columnist for the website. He put out a bunch of articles, and actually today is actually the anniversary of his passing. He died a year ago from lung cancer. But so antiwar.com, it's a libertarian website. But it's the whole idea, it's kind of a one issue idea, you know, ending the empire, ending war, is something that we can all unite behind, whether you're left, right, libertarian, anarchist, you know, left wing anarchist, right wing, whoever you are, you know, and we'll run your article. We run, pieces from all over the political spectrum. And that's kind of the idea of it. The news section that I'm involved in has been around since there's always been news, but Jason Ditz has been writing in there since 2003, since the invasion of Iraq, when things really got busy for them. And so the news section, it's a useful resource every day. Jason's in there. I'm in there at least one or two days a week. And we just follow all the developments in the wars in the Middle East. And we try to stay on top of the new Cold War with China. That's an area I'm pretty concerned about. And the stuff with Russia, NATO stuff, nuclear arms talks. So, yeah, it's a pretty good resource for people. So I would encourage everybody you could subscribe to the daily newsletter.
I was going to say, too, I like that you mentioned that it's a libertarian website that sort of publishes all different kinds of viewpoints that are anti-war from across the political spectrum. I remember back in, you know, my teen years when I was reading it, people would say, oh, they're just a bunch of radical lefties. And I'm like, I don't think that's the case. It's interesting, too, because you guys are equal opportunity. You know, you just did an article before the David McGatty one that we're going to talk about Steve Bannon and, you know, his, you know, China warmongering. So it's not like a website that people can put in like an easy box politically. It's just anti-war.
Yeah. Yeah.
So getting into this article, The Danger of Sending in the Troops, The Killing of David McGatty, let's just take a step back. Before we get into the killing of McGatty, who was David McGatty? What's the sketch of who he was?
So David McGatty was a barbecue chef. He owned a business in Louisville, Kentucky. He was 53 years old. And he was, after he was killed, he was loved by his community. Everybody had kind words for him. They said he was really generous. He would feed homeless for free. He would even feed the cops for free. He had a really good relationship with the local PD. He was a community leader, small business owner, you know, kind of the American, what you would think when you think of pursuing the American dream, which might sound silly to say now, but you know what I mean. He was a small business owner, community leader. Everybody seemed to really love this guy.
Yeah, his restaurant was Yaya's Barbecue.
Yeah, Yaya's Barbecue was the name.
And what leads to his unfortunate death. This happens after the murder of George Floyd at the hands of Minneapolis police. The protests erupt. Give us a picture of what's going on leading up to his death.
So the night he was killed, it was June 1st, right after midnight. So it was a Sunday night. It was the first weekend that when the protests really erupted across the country in the wake of the murder of George Floyd. And so a lot of cities, because there was some looting, and that was the excuse for cities to enact curfews. A lot of states activated the National Guard to enforce these curfews. And where David McAtee was at his restaurant, Gaia's Barbecue, every report I read, they were miles away from any protests. But there was a 9 p.m. curfew, so the people that were out that night were technically in violation of it. And across the street was a shop called Dino's Food Mart, where there was a crowd gathered, and the police, about 30 cops and National Guard soldiers, showed up to disperse that crowd. And there's some cell phone video from that area, and it looks like the cops were telling people to leave. They gave them a chance to leave. But then in the surveillance video from Yaya's Barbecue, released by the police, you see a few cops start crossing the street over to Yaya's, where there's some people in front. And the surveillance video showed just a couple seconds, maybe less than a minute before the cops started crossing the street, David McAtee was out there tending to his grills. So the cops, instead of announcing themselves, they immediately start firing pepper balls at the crowd. And this causes panic, and people start running in to the barbecue restaurant, which is where David was at the time. They also released surveillance video from inside the restaurant, and a crowd starts rushing in to his restaurant, and you could see David goes to push himself through the crowd to the door to see what's going on. And the cops continue to fire pepper balls. I guess the crowd going inside wasn't enough it didn't make the cops happy enough, because they kept firing the pepper balls. And one of the last people that enters the restaurant is McAtee's niece, who the cops, I think they say she wasn't hit by a pepper ball, but the witnesses and David's nephew, Marvin, who was there, said that she was hit in the shoulder. So one of the last people to come in was David's niece. And as he's pushing to the door, it looks like he reaches for a gun on his hip. He was a gun owner, like a lot of people in Kentucky are. And the angles that they released, it's really hard to tell exactly what happened, but it looks like he took his gun out and raised it in the air and maybe fired a warning shot. That's when the cops claim that he fired, but he wasn't. It looked like his arm was straight in the air. And then he kind of ducked in for a few seconds, and then he creeped out again. And that's when the National Guard, who were behind the cops, the cops and the National Guard both started shooting at the restaurant, at the doorway. And a National Guard bullet.
They unloaded, I think, 18 rounds.
18 rounds, yeah.
Whoa.
And a National Guard bullet, one bullet hit David in the chest and killed him. And you see him collapse in the video.
And so he's not a protester.
No, that's an important, very important detail, is that he's not a protester, and he was hanging out in his business on his property and his home. He lived in the basement apartment there. So he was killed in the doorway of his home.
And also, I think he was talking to police prior to this. I think it was suggested that, oh, maybe you should think about getting a gun, or, you know, having your gun at hand, because there may be looting because of these protests and whatnot. Am I correct about that?
Yeah, that's what his nephew Marvin, he's done a lot of interviews with the press, and he said that the cops were in there a few days before and advising him to protect himself because there was some looting going on. Yeah, and that shows the relationship that he had with the police.
Yeah, he would feed them every day, I think. I mean, he was real tight with the police force there.
Yeah, they said he would like refuse to take their money. They would have to throw it down on the counter when he had his back turned. So yeah, that's what's a shame about it, is that he did everything right. And I mean that in like this, the perspective of like the right wing, like NRA type people. You know, he's a business owner. He defended himself. You know, he carried a gun, and he was friendly with the, he had a great relationship with the local police. There was a young cop that was only on the force for about a year that was friends that grew up and knew him from the neighborhood. You know, I mentioned in my article, he made a pretty heartfelt Facebook post about just how devastated he was. And, you know, it makes people ask, like, the Louisville PD, they violated their guidelines that night because their rules to disperse for crowd dispersal, they're supposed to announce themselves and give people time to disperse and they're supposed to do it nonviolently if the crowd's nonviolent. But they just came in firing pepper balls. They initiated the violence. And from the time they started shooting those pepper balls to the time Dave McAtee was killed, it's only about 45 seconds. So who knows what he thought was happening? All these people rushing in. His nephew said a lot of them were strangers. They ran down to his basement apartment and they said they thought they might have been getting looted. They weren't sure what was going on. He maintains that his uncle wouldn't have knowingly fired at police. And they never found they found spent casings next to his gun, but they never found the bullet like in the ground anywhere. So that points to him, you know, shooting in the air as a warning shot.
I was going to say, it reminds me of the Tatiana Jefferson case in Texas. She was babysitting, I think it was her nephew, and there was a routine checkup call made because someone saw that the sliding glass door was open, because she wanted it open apparently because of she wanted to get a nice breeze coming in the house. And there was a routine checkup call made, like, to see how she was. And it wasn't, you know, a 9/11 call. And she heard noise outside. So she goes to the window and she has her gun on her. And it's in her house. She's allowed to do that. And then the cop says, police. And then within a second in the video, bam, he just shoots her. There's no time to even react. And I guess people would say, oh, well, she had a gun on her. And I mean, it's the same thing with McAtee. I mean, he had a gun on him, but in both cases, I mean, it's their property. They're allowed to have a gun on them. That's my view, at least.
Yeah. I mean, that's my view too. And I wish there was more attention on this case here. I think maybe because it looks like he did fire first that I don't know. This is not as much attention, maybe for that reason. Another detail that's important is that the cop that started firing the pepper balls, her name is Katie Cruz. She posted on Facebook a few days before, like, a picture of protesters giving her flowers. And in the caption, she said something like, oh, they were doing a lot more than giving me flowers. I hope those pepper balls that they got lit up with, like, later stung. And then, like, she said something like, come back and get more tonight. I'll be back out on the line. Whoa. So she clearly, yeah, like, was a trigger happy cop that enjoyed, might have been a power trip. You know, it was a black neighborhood where McAtee's business was. She might have enjoyed going in there and just being able to light people up, kind of a power trip thing. I mean, there was no reason to keep firing into that door. And a point that the family's lawyer made.
That's Stephen Romines, or maybe I'm mispronouncing his name.
Romines, that's what. Yeah, I think that's how you pronounce it. I'm not sure, to be honest with you. But he made the point that the people who get the benefit of the doubt in these situations are cops. Like, how many times have the police, like, shot a kid because he had a toy gun on him in a park or something? Here in New York, a few years ago, there was a mentally ill man in Crown Heights, Brooklyn, who was had like he had a pipe in his hand and he was going around pointing it at people, and the cops shot him like 9, 10 times. It's just a shame, and I titled it "The Danger of Sending in the Troops" because I think it really highlights the danger. And I mean, enacting curfews, one, and two, sending in an army to put down, to enforce them. I mean, he wasn't, not only was he not a looter or a rioter, he wasn't even a protester.
Well, I mean, but by society standards, he was the guy that played by the rules.
Yeah, exactly.
And I guess,
you know, there has been some ramifications, at least. I know the mayor apparently took issue with the officers not having their body cameras activated.
Yeah, that's right. I think that it happened only a day or two after he was killed. The cops, the two that fired their guns, it was two cops and two National Guards soldiers that fired their weapons. The cops didn't have their body cameras on. So the mayor fired the police chief like the next day, and the two officers were put on administrative leave, which means they're getting paid to stay home. And the National Guard, they're not releasing the name. They're not going to have any liability, I don't think, the National Guard. I don't think anybody's really going to have to answer this except for, you know, that police chief because of the body cam situation. But, yeah. And then Louisville, they had another reason to protest, not just George Floyd, but Breonna Taylor was killed by the cops in her home in March of this year. So they were protesting for her just as much as for George Floyd. And, of course, you know, overall police brutality. And to just go over Breonna Taylor real quick.
I was interested in getting a little bit more into that.
Yeah, she was killed in a no-knock raid. Cops kicked her door down, and her boyfriend, Kenneth Walker, who another gun owner, fired at the cops, and then they unloaded. I'm not sure how many rounds, but they killed her. They killed Breonna Taylor, 26-year-old EMT, and in my piece, I linked to you could look it up, the 911 phone call that Kenneth Walker made. It's really horrific to listen to because you could hear it in his voice that he's realizing that his girlfriend's dead. But he had no idea it was cops. He thought that they were just being raided. No reason to think that cops would kick down their door. From what I understand, they got a tip from the Postal Service that drugs were being mailed, the packages were being mailed to their apartment. But apparently the drug dealer was already in custody, and it might have been the wrong, not even the right apartment. It was just a mess. I mean, they had no reason to do it. And they banned these no-knock raids in Louisville, Kentucky. So that's something. I mean, I think Rand Paul introduced a bill to ban them, but I don't think that'll get very far in the Congress.
Yeah, I was just going to say it's insane to me the level of just the way that police and even the Kentucky National Guard has reacted in cases like this. The Kentucky National Guard official, according to your article, just went on and on about, oh, this civil unrest mission is one of the most difficult homeland missions we are asked to support. The soldiers and airmen are of the highest caliber, and we believe that our internal investigation will conclude that it was a measured response from the National Guard that night. And I'm just thinking to myself, they always have to put that in there, like, we're the good guys, don't criticize us, you know. I'm sure we'll have a good internal investigation, that'll fix everything.
Yeah, and that's the attitude. Like I said, if we sent in the 82nd Airborne like Tom Cotton wanted to, there would have been a lot more David McAtees, I think. Because I usually – all my columns are usually – this is the first thing I've written about domestic incident, really, because unfortunately, a U.S. soldier killed an American citizen.
And, I mean, it does tie into antiwar.com. I mean, this is – a war issue.
Yeah,
this is war on American citizens at home.
Yeah, absolutely. We covered, you know, a lot of the police brutality stuff and we try to highlight when, I mean, that's another thing we do. If somebody in Congress introduces a good bill, no matter who it is, we'll highlight that, like Rand Paul's bill to ban the no-knock raids and Justin Amash's and Qualified Immunity Act. Unfortunately, I don't think they'll get very far, but at least some states are making, I think Colorado ended the qualified immunity. Louisville banned the no-knock raids. I think that other cities and states are doing their own thing. It'd be really hard to get anything passed federally, I think, with the Republican Senate, but at least some change is happening.
It's really crazy to think about the fact that police and the National Guard are sort of just we're expected to think they're going to do internal investigations of these incidents, and oh, they'll fix it. I'm just amazed at the level of, you know, there's just not a care in the world when it comes to how we respond to these type of incidents now. I mean, I think there should be probably external investigations, to be honest.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. Set up some sort of third-party investigation team. And all I've seen that David's family is asking for, his nephew Marvin just wants an apology from the Louisville PD. He said, and this is as of a week ago, I haven't seen any updated stories on this recently, but he said nobody's come down because he's running the barbecue shop now and just said, yeah, we're sorry. That's all, like, he just wants a real apology for all the things that, all the looking out for the local cops that they've done. And he just feels, you know, that they don't even have the decency to just apologize, you know, outside of an investigation, outside of somebody going to getting fired or going to jail. Just like a man-to-man apology, and that's all he's really looking for. I can't even get that.
Yeah, he said no police came here and shook my hand and said I'm sorry for your loss or nothing. They just didn't do that, which, I mean, it's pretty shocking when you think about how close McAtee was to these police. But I guess there has been a lot of community support for Marvin and his family in this difficult time.
Yeah, there has been. I think they raised a lot of money through a GoFundMe for funeral costs and other costs. I forget who started it. I think maybe, do you know anything about that?
No. Go on.
Because I want to say it was like a professional athlete maybe from the city started a GoFundMe and they got a bunch. But they raised a lot of money for the family, which is good.
And I guess wrapping up on that article, and then I want to briefly touch on your article concerning Yemen, I guess maybe we could talk a little bit about what do you think the broader implications of calling in the National Guard are? I mean, this is sort of illustrative of what happens when we enact curfews and call in the army to quell civil unrest.
Yeah. I mean, this is how it always will end up. And kind of from a personal experience, you know, I live in South Brooklyn and my other job is on Staten Island. And I've been commuting through, you know, neighborhoods in South Brooklyn and Staten Island. And when the protest started and there was some looting in Manhattan, we had a curfew. And technically going out, it's a license for the cops to harass you. And it's a license for them to start, I guess, shooting these pepper balls at you. For no reason. And, you know, New York's a big city. There was looting in like one stretch of Manhattan. And instead of sending these armies of cops to confront peaceful protesters or block them, they were blocking them on the bridges going into Manhattan. You know, I think they could have actually protected the property that was being looted. But instead, they were busy out there enforcing these curfews and just kind of just dragging everything out.
And I want to ask too, has there been any other outlets putting attention on McAtee's death? I know, I would assume that Black Lives Matter or black activists would be very interested in this case because I believe he was a black small business owner.
Yeah, he was. I mean, a lot of people are out there, you know, are saying his name, you know, he's included in that long list of recent of black people killed at the hands of law enforcement. Most everything the local papers has done a good job on it. The Courier Journal, it's like USA Today's local Kentucky media outlet. But it did kind of feel like this story didn't get enough attention. And another reason why I decided to write it was because, I mean, there's that horrific story. I mean, looters, they killed I'm not sure if he was a business owner, but he was going to, it was another black guy. He was a retired cop or something. And he was killed kind of by like a mob. And that got so much attention. And then here is, you know, a black small business owner protecting his property and getting gunned down by the National Guard. You know, he is that demographic that kind of, because there was a brief moment there after that horrible video of George Floyd being killed came out where everybody was like, yeah, this is really bad. Even the right wingers, even some MAGA people. But then as soon as like one window was broken, that became the focus. And the focus, and of course, when that business owner was killed by looters. But here we have a business owner, you know, the people that they profess to care so much about that they kind of turn the conversation to. Well, here we have one being killed by the cops and National Guard for this arbitrary curfew. And you have all these people saying to call in the army, send an army to New York. Well, I'm here in New York and we're fine. It's just one part of Manhattan that could use some help. And yeah, that was kind of my idea behind writing it.
You know, I was going to add real quickly, since you're in New York, I keep trying to explain to people, I'm like, the issue I really have with policing in America today, one of the big issues, is police do not look like they did when I was growing up. Over the years, just the way they look has changed. And what I mean by that is they look more and more militarized. The way they dress, the gear they have. We've seen the absolute militarization of the police. And I know there's like a variety of organizations in New York that have been putting attention on that. Maybe you could comment just briefly on the militarization of the police.
Well, especially in New York, I mean, since 9/11, and it's not just besides the NYPD, we have Homeland Security armed to the teeth, National Guard in our train stations and in our public transportation. So, I mean, you really see it in New York City, especially in Manhattan, like the extra security since 9/11. And also just if you look at the cop cars that and just the sheer number of police. Yeah, I mean, the militarization of police is something, you know, it's not like really my ballpark. I'm not too knowledgeable about it. It's something I'm very concerned about, but obviously. But it is like the case of what we call the empire coming home. You know, we go around and police the entire world and do night raids in Afghanistan. And you know, that comes home to us. If, you know, we say Black Lives Matter, you know, I think a big part of it, just of our culture, is that we have to, I mean, I don't want to like downplay anything that people are protesting against, but I think we really have to address the empire and occupation in Palestine. Palestinian lives have to matter. Yemeni lives have to matter. Afghan Muslim lives have to matter too. Because our government has killed millions of people in the Middle East since in my lifetime. I was born in 1990 and killed millions. I mean, it's a genocide, and it's something that we don't. A lot of people don't even think about, and I wish it was more of a. I know that a ton of great activists are out there, Black Lives Matter activists that care about these things too. But I wish it was kind of more part of the conversation, because it is the way that we have all this like we're made to worship the military in this country. You know, that's all part of it, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when Iraq broke out. If you so much as said that you don't support the war in Iraq, you know, people would immediately say, oh, you don't support our troops. And I was just like, whoa, like, it's not even about hating the troops. It's about innocent people are getting murdered.
Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of that is like, you know, the NFL comes to mind. They have all that I don't really watch football anymore, but I used to. And it was all Navy commercials, Marine Corps, all presented by blah, blah, blah. And that was
Oh, my God. I was going to say, if you would go to concerts for rock bands back during when the Iraq War first started or NHL games, it was like they would open up the shows with, like, military people coming down from the rafters and, like, video packages. I'm like, what? Am I living in, like, a Lenny Riefenstahl movie?
Whew. Yeah. And one thing, it's funny because they're back in the news, the Dixie Chicks, who I haven't thought about in a long time, they spoke out against the war, and they and Clear Channel and like the Bush administration, they like pressured radio stations to not play their music. And that's another thing. It's a little story about antiwar.com, because one of Justin Raimondo's, his column on 9/11 was like, you know, the empire came home, kind of blowback was the gist of it, which, I mean, I was young when that happened, but writing that right after 9/11, the rabid patriotism that was going on, that's, you know, pretty brave. And apparently they were getting a lot of threats, a lot of like death threats and stuff.
Well, I think they were, I think there were issues with the FBI for a while.
Yeah, well, they, Eric told, reported some of this stuff to the FBI because he was nervous. And then the FBI started like surveilling them. They recently just dropped, just had to drop the case, which the details I'm not too great on of that case, but it's on the website if anybody wants to check it out. FBI versus antiwar.com. But what? Yeah, I mean.
Go on.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say just that worship, fetishization of the military is all a part of it, I think.
You know, I think we are living in the long shadow of 9/11's aftermath. A lot of people don't want to admit that or have forgotten, but I mean, this carceral state that we live in now, you know, the sort of police state measures that are taken across the country, it happens in large part as a reaction to 9/11, where you have unprecedented power given to the Department of Homeland Security, the Patriot Act. It's continued after Bush with Obama, the supposed Democrat who would be against all of that, and now with Trump, who you know, was trying to say, oh, I'm the anti-war guy. It doesn't seem like it's panned out that way, though.
No. Over 3 years in office now, and he hasn't ended a war. And I think he really did have the instinct to pull out of Afghanistan and Syria, but he rolled over. And, you know, there was a lot of pressure. And, like, you know, the so-called deep state or whatever you want to call it does come out in force to stop those decisions. But I think he rolled over. Like, the Syria withdrawal he could have pulled off, but he rolled over right away. Oh, there's oil? Oh, we got to stay there to protect the oil.
And meanwhile, we're making, you know, establishment Democrats are making a hero out of John Bolton on the other end of this equation. It's ridiculous.
It is, yeah. And that's and all this just it's like attacking Trump from the right on all issues of war and just kind of turning people into hawks. Like, oh, he said Maduro in Venezuela was like he was realistic about the situation in Maduro in Venezuela because he said he doesn't think Guaido can take over and same thing with even just meeting with Xi Jinping, the things that he might have said to him, which I don't believe everything Bolton says, but it's just making diplomacy like with our so-called adversary countries like the worst, making it seem like it's like the worst thing when it was one of Trump's his few attributes, I thought, was that he was willing to meet with world leaders. And then, but he surrounded himself with the worst people, John Bolton, Mike Pompeo, and they sabotaged everything.
Well, one of the things I really respect about antiwar.com is the consistency. So I remember when a lot of this stuff was happening with Venezuela, I was listening to Scott Horton of the Scott Horton Show, which is very connected to antiwar.com. And he said, well, you know, if Venezuela wants to be socialist, who are we to tell them that they can't be socialist? Like, you don't, you know, try to coup a country and their leadership just because you don't like what they're doing in their own country. They're not even bothering you. And I've always felt that anti-war was consistent on the front of being against intervention.
Yeah. Yeah. Because if you look at it in the aspect, I don't look at me personally. I don't look at things as communist and capitalist. I look at authoritarian governments and stuff. And if you look at it, like the biggest authoritarian government in the world is the U.S. government with our sanctions and our wars, how we bully other countries into, you know, doing what we want. So it's just funny when, like, the cries of socialism as Trump presides over the largest Pentagon budget ever. And just, yeah, I mean, that's the way I look at things, is our government is the most authoritarian and it's the biggest in the history. So we don't have the right to tell people that their government, like, how to spend their, do what they should do with their natural resources in their country.
If you have a few more minutes, I just want to briefly cover your latest piece on antiwar.com, June 22nd, 2020. As coronavirus rips through Yemen, Saudi bombs continue to fall. Would you be able to give an outline of that?
Yeah, sure. So the war in Yemen, I mean, it's I think it's one of the worst. I mean, the UN calls it the world's worst humanitarian crisis. And it's really one of the worst atrocities going on in the world, if not the worst. So just I guess I'll give a quick background. In 2015, the Saudi Arabia, the UAE, other Gulf countries, they declared war. I don't know if they formally declared it, but they started a war on Yemen after the Houthis took control of the capital, Sana'a, and other major cities, and they ousted President Hadi. And with full U.S. backing, the Obama administration started it. Full support, intelligence, refueled planes, sold weapons, you know. And now with the coronavirus, I mean, things are really bad there. The coalition has regularly bombed civilian infrastructure, schools, hospitals, water treatment facilities, farms, fishing boats. I mean, you name it, and they've bombed it.
Well, they're also facing a cholera outbreak, food shortages on top of this pandemic.
Yes, yeah. So cholera, they faced the largest modern-day cholera outbreak, and it's entirely man-made. It started in 2016 and really exploded in 2017 because cholera can be treated with clean water or antibiotics. It's really easy to treat, but the war against civilians that this war is, I count it, one piece I did, the Yemen Data Project, they've compiled a spreadsheet of all the airstrikes that they can identify where they hit, and I counted almost 100 airstrikes hit water treatment facilities, whether or water targets, water tanks, water trucks, and it's a crazy number. It's more than half of the population doesn't have access to clean water, and they can't wash their hands. So they're really susceptible to the COVID-19, and it's apparently it's really exploded there. And it's just another thing on top of the war and the cholera and the food shortages. Right now, about 80% of Yemen's population is reliant on aid. About like 12 million face famine. The population is around 29 million. And in the midst of all this, there's been aid cuts. The World Food Program have their aid into the country. The USAID, the suspended aid, and the UN cut about 75% of its programs. And it seems kind of silly, like the US is fully responsible for the siege on the country and like asking them to send aid into the country, but they need it. I mean, they just suspended it to the Houthi controlled areas, which is where 70% of the population lives. So whether our government likes it or not, that's who's in charge there, and that is where people are in dire need of aid.
Well,
and they can't...
even if you don't like the Houthi government, these Yemeni civilians need aid, and
yeah,
it's screwing over them. Even if you don't like the government, you're hurting the people in that area.
Yeah, yeah, it's a war on civilians. It's really just a horrific situation. And, you know, the predictions that the UN predicted, if the war ended in 2019, over like 233,000 people would have died by, you know, between the violence and then the other, you know, food shortages and disease that's happened as a result of the war. And that was if it ended in 2019, and now it's well into 2020. And with coronavirus on top of it, it's just and the vast majority, like all of these wars and sanctions and blockades, the majority of the people dying are children. Children under five are starving to death. They're born into starvation. And this is all, I mean, it's the Saudis' war, but it's they couldn't do it without the United States, without our arms sales and our support. And there's been efforts in Congress to stop the war, good efforts led by anti-war activists in Washington. They passed War Powers Act. I mean, the legislation itself wasn't the best for that one. It said that we couldn't have like troops in Yemen if they weren't fighting Al-Qaeda. But it was something. And then they passed legislation to block arms sales to Saudi Arabia and UAE, which Trump vetoed all this. He's used most of his veto power for warmongering because he also vetoed a War Powers resolution that they passed for the Iran stuff, that they didn't want him starting a war with Iran. And he vetoed that. And they just announced another they're selling some missiles, precision-guided missiles to Saudi Arabia, which they announced recently. And
$478 million worth, as I understand it.
Yes, yeah, yeah. So it's a lot. And, I mean, if we stop selling them weapons, then we could easily pressure Saudi Arabia into ending this war and getting these people the aid that they need and getting the country set up to start being more – it's just such a dire situation. And it's really, people use the word, I don't like to throw the word genocide around, but that's what, that's, if you just look, if you read these numbers, I try to do a piece on Yemen once in a while, and I kind of just, it's just full of numbers that I just throw out there. And it's just, that's what it is. It's a war on civilians to pacify them, to drive the Houthis out. And it's a failure because the Houthis are in control. They're getting better technology and they're firing drones and missiles into Saudi Arabia. And even in South Yemen, there's a separatist group that's broken off. They want, because Yemen was two countries until 1990, North and South, and the separatist group wants to bring back South Yemen. And so it's just a mess. I mean, they're not, like a lot of our wars in the Middle East, there's no victory in sight. And it's just it's just money making for the war profiteers, and everybody calls it Iranian influence. We have to fight the war. Iran will be there. The Houthis are an Iranian proxy, they say, which isn't true. They might have some political support and some support from Iran, but it's an entirely homegrown uprising. The Houthi, the Zaydi Shia, they ruled the area of Yemen that they now control. Zaydi Shia imams ruled it for 1,000 years until 1962.
I wanted to make two comments on that front real quickly here. The first is whenever we talk about Iran, it's always Iran is like the great bad guy all the time. I remember when there were issues going on with Iraq with IEDs killing troops. People were saying, oh, the Iranians are helping these rebels make the IEDs. And I said to people, I'm like, well, if they are doing that, they're only doing it because you're telling them they have the target on their back next for when we leave Iraq. We're going to go and take Iran next. The other thing is we always talk about Iranian influence, but Saudi Arabia is apparently untouchable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, and if you look at what people accuse Iran of arming the Houthis, which isn't entirely true. They could have, I think they might have helped them with some technology, designing some things maybe. I'm not sure. Nobody really knows. They capture boats with missiles on them once in a while. The blockade does going into Yemen, and they say it was sent from Iran, but nobody really knows. Apparently a lot of it comes from Somalia. But the fact is, like, the United States is the one that's giving arms to the biggest human rights abuser in this war, which is the Saudi coalition that's just raining hell on the civilians of Yemen. So even if Iran, because the Houthis have fired, they've had some successful attacks inside Saudi Arabia. They put out their oil production for a few days. And even if Iran did that, it's nothing compared to what the Saudis are doing. And, you know, that's a big part of the excuse is why we're still supporting the war. Well, if we don't support the Saudis here, then Iran's going to be able to attack Saudi Arabia from Yemen. It's like, at what cost are we stopping Iranian influence? Hundreds of thousands of civilians' lives, children's lives, it's just not worth it. And if we didn't support Saudi Arabia at all, if we just stopped, they would negotiate, they would work it out with Iran, I think. That's one thing that apparently Soleimani was doing, the Iranian general that Trump assassinated in January when he was in Iraq. Iraq was was working out peace talks between Saudi Arabia and Iran. They were mediating them. And, you know, that's when Trump drone bombed them and killed them. So we don't want that. We don't want Saudi Arabia and Iran working things out, because then the U.S. is no longer needed, I guess.
Well, I mean, the Saudi relationship is always a little bit mind-boggling to me, because, you know, it seems like that's the one country in the Middle East that the U.S. won't really touch. I mean, and antiwar.com has covered this, you know, the 28 pages of the 9/11 report detailing the Saudi connections. I mean, Saudi Arabia has a very checkered political history recently, and yet we always focus on Iran. And I'm not saying we should interfere in, like, Saudi business either. I'm just saying the hypocrisy is so in your face when it comes to the relationship with Saudi Arabia and the U.S. as compared to Iran and the U.S.
Yeah, there's been some good journalism from CNN, actually. There was a report that showed it was particularly weapons that we sold to the UAE, but also Saudi Arabia, that ended up in the hands of Al-Qaeda in Yemen, which is, like, very well known. I mean, people know that the in Syria, in Yemen, Libya, all these arms that we flood these regions with, they end up in who are on paper supposed to be our enemy, is like the reason that we're there in the first place. But it just continues. It's just the circle of, you know, weapons and war and switching sides. And it's just like a never ending cycle, it seems like.
Do you think that relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia has any chance of, I don't know, souring? I know after Khashoggi's death, there was a lot of pushback from just the worldwide citizenry.
There was a moment there where I was hopeful that it would change. And I wonder if somebody else was president, if it, I mean, not Hillary Clinton, but because I mean, Trump really likes that relationship. He loves deals. He loves selling them billions of dollars in weapons. I mean, I don't know if this doesn't outrage people enough. I mean, Khashoggi, sometimes that's what it takes, is an individual that people know. He was a Washington Post writer, and that really outraged everybody. But if this war isn't outraging people enough, and I don't know, I really don't see it, because I think if we have a president, say Biden comes in, he might continue this stuff and it'll go a lot more under the radar, because like Obama, his wars were just a lot quieter.
The happy face of the empire.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it could just continue if and I don't think Biden, I mean, I think he said that he would end the war in Yemen, but I think it would still take a lot of effort from activists in Congress to really end this.
I think the UN has called it, like, the world's worst humanitarian, you know, crisis.
Yeah, they have. They just took the Saudis off of a list of parties that harm children in conflicts, which I mentioned in the piece here. And then the same day that they took them off that list, the news broke that an airstrike hit a vehicle in North Yemen, killed 13 civilians, including 4 children. And which Saudis denied, but Save the Children was on the ground there. the Houthis and the UN's like investigation into it, it all pointed to civilians and children being killed. So they do have, I think they have a bias in the conflict, the UN. I mean, like the humanitarian coordinators, they all say it has to end, but then like the actual UN chief, who's like brokering the peace talks, he has like a Saudi Hadi government bias. You know, there, that's still the internationally recognized government of Yemen, even though Hadi has been running the country from a hotel room in Riyadh. And I mean, he's the reason why the people of Yemen have experienced this horrible air campaign and blockade. So I don't think that they would want him to be in charge, you know, at the end of this. It's just like, it's just a fool's errand to try to put Hadi back in charge here.
Well, I think we've done a good job on this edition of Parallax News covering, you know, what I can only call the fulfillment of what Gore Vidal was talking about in his series of books about the American empire. This is like the culmination of the empire. It's the nightmare of the empire, both at home and abroad. And I think we really laid that out for people here with two very specific examples in the form of David McCatty's death and also the war in Yemen. Dave, I want to give you a chance to let my listeners know how they can follow your work and anything else you want to plug.
Yeah, read antiwar.com. And you can follow me on Twitter at DecampDave. And I try to do a weekly column in the viewpoint section at antiwar.com. It usually goes up Mondays. And then I'm also in the news section. And so I'm trying to do as much as I can. And soon I think we're going to be able to do a lot more. So yeah, keep an eye on it. That's where I'll be.
Thank you again, Dave DeCamp, for coming on Parallax Views.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me on.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you found my conversation with Dave DeCamp informative, and I hope you'll consider keeping up with his work at antiwar.com. Let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Also, if you can, please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Trying to make a push for more Patreon subscriptions. Gonna need those to keep this project going at a full steam ahead pace. So if you can, consider making a donation to me by way of Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said,
until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.